Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Listen in as we discuss all things business, growth, and marketing with business owners, thought leaders, and entrepreneurs. And now, here's your host, founder of Roundhouse, the creative agency, Saul Edmonds.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Today, I am speaking with Dr. Adam Fraser around the topic, top hacks to succeeding in the hybrid work environment. Adam, how are you going today?
I am very good. Thank you very much. Excited to be here and to have a chat.
Yeah. Likewise. It's a as I'm sure many people even seeing the topic would realize it's fairly topical at the moment. Of course.
Yes.
It's kind of an overstatement, isn't it? Right now.
Yeah, it's a bit of an overstatement.
It's huge. It's not too far from saying like it's probably one of the best times to be speaking about something like this.
Yeah, it's interesting that a number of years ago we did this research on the third space and how we transition not only from work to home, but also the micro transitions of our day, so one meeting to another. So we've had that research out for quite a while, and the reason we've re-released the book, The Third Space, is because the commute disappeared. So we started to do research on how do we transition from work to home when they're in the same space. So
I know, right? Yeah. I mean, reading a little bit, not having known you before or having had a look at any of your work, and having a fairly good look at what you've been talking about with the third space, and especially the new addition to that book. I find it really fascinating with what we talk about, that we can dive into a little bit more about the idea of spaces and the sort of the spaces within them, those transitions. Yeah. That's like something that really sort of captured my imagination. But before, I guess, we get into all of that, if you'd like to, for everybody listening who has no idea of who you are, if you'd like to give everyone, I guess, an overview of who you are, just a brief introductory history to give them a bit of sort of context, that'd be great.
My undergraduate was in biomedical science, which is a blend of psychology and physiology, and then did a stint working with Olympic athletes around performance. Came back, did a PhD looking at how lifestyle affects our well-being as well as our happiness. And from there, started to do a lot of keynote speaking and consulting to organizations. And our company, the eLab, which is our research arm of our business, we partner with different universities around the world to do large research projects. So like what we're talking about today is the research we've done on how COVID and working from home has affected us. Mm-hmm. We've also just wrapped up a big research project looking at the mental health and well-being of financial advisors in Australia. So we right. work on these very large scale research projects, and then we share that information through presentations and books and workshops and programs. So that's me, married to two young daughters, a dog, the usual stuff. So I spend my time in those three areas, either presenting, doing research, or working on large scale interventions.
Yeah, great. I mean, I have to say too, I noted on your website, I think it's on the homepage, it says, in the last 8 years, you've delivered more than 1,200 presentations to over 300,000 people in Australia, New Zealand, and Asia. So that's no mean feat. That's epic.
Yeah, I mean,
that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, 120 to 140 presentations a year for the last 15 years.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah. So
that would keep you quite busy, Adam.
Yes, very much. And to tell you the truth, COVID has totally changed my life and my outlook and how I view work. And I went from someone that flew, well, a lot, so much so Qantas used to send me wine at Christmas to say thank you, to, you know, being home every night. And it was amazing. I loved it. And, you know, obviously I'm not going to go back to that sort of crazy lifestyle. And we're changing the business to suit that.
Yeah, I think that's certainly something a lot of friends or other business colleagues, and actually ourselves included, like I was probably working a little bit more from home anyway before COVID hit. Yeah. So the transition wasn't a really dramatic one for me, but I've talked to so many people who've said exactly the same thing, that it's had an incredibly positive impact on them. You know, ironically, which was the other response that was then, and that was completely unexpected, of course, because, you know, it's a pandemic, which is not good, and you don't expect necessarily good things to follow from something like that. But then the outcome, you know, this through this sort of winding series of events then leads to all these other things, which is amazing, I think. I just wanted to return to, I guess, what I mentioned a little bit earlier, which was a real, point of interest that really stood out to me, this idea of, the transitions between the different spaces that you refer to. And and the first thing that I kind of, you know, jumped to was this idea of the spaces within the spaces. Would you just like to, I guess, speak a little bit about how that works within the third space?
Yeah, it was probably influenced by a lot of different things. So different interactions. Even with soldiers talking about how moving from the space of being a soldier, then coming home, was the hardest thing that they did. Business people talking about the capacity to rapidly transition between one meeting to another. Even when I worked in sport, you know, people in sport talked about the fact that the champions manage the gaps, and the gaps are that sort of transitional space in between points. So if you're a tennis player, how do you go from one point to another where you leave the disappointment of the previous point behind, but get your head right for the next point? So what it all translated into is that we basically just move between spaces. So the first space is what you're doing now, second space, what you're about to do. So if I think about my day, you know, I've gone from being a dad in the morning, trying to get my kids out of the house, which is no easy feat. Then I come in, I did an interview on the radio. Then I had a sales call. Then I did a presentation. Then I went to the gym. Now I'm talking to you. Now I'm about to go home. So what it is just that the third space is that transitional gap in between. It's kind of the micro space in between what you do. So that's what we started to look at, is obviously the transition from work to home is a larger space, but it can be like we taught this strategy to 000 responders, and they're taking emergency phone calls, and that gap can be 3 seconds, but that ability to reset themselves so that they are on point, can take the information, calm the other person, empathize with them, it's a critical skill. So what we found is high performers had that ability, that agility to really transition between spaces quickly.
Yeah, you talk about, and then there's the term that you mentioned, which is obviously what you're speaking about, of behavioral agility. Is that specifically what you were just speaking about, or is that then something else?
No, that's very, very much it. It's that behavioral agility to kind of get over what you've just gone through, particularly if it's been a disappointing interaction, but get your head right for the thing you're about to move into.
Yeah. I think like the probably why I would imagine, I'm not sure how other people would generally respond first when they hear what you're speaking about, but the first reason why I feel like it stood out to me was because all the previous conversations that I had heard or read or seen videos about in relation to, you know, the work home, you know, work life balance, never really talked about those transitional points. And it was always about, you know, the importance of work-life balance, and then ideas about why that's good and, you know, and how you can achieve things better, but never that those little points. And maybe it also had something to do with my, you know, I've always loved playing sport and I play squash and some of those very points, which I don't think I ever realized, perhaps the importance of those transitions. It was like, oh, right, yeah, that's something that is kind of makes a lot of sense, really. You know, it's like, you know, there's the gap in between and you go from here to here and you feel a certain way and you can't get out of maybe a certain mode, but then how do you do that? And there's a little space in between. And
And what our research showed is that too often we drag the mood and the mindset of one thing into another. So we have a bad meeting, we take it to the next meeting. Or we have a bad day, we take it home. Or even just, you know, we go from one meeting that's about process and like, frustrating bureaucracy, and then we move into a meeting that's supposed to be about innovation and big, you know, blue sky thinking, but we bring that mentality of the minutiae and the micromanagement into that meeting, and it doesn't allow us to be innovative. So what we found is a lot of people aren't aware of how they show up, or just flat out they're not aware of that space or how they should use it to show up better. So yeah, we kind of squander it, or we drag the previous interaction into that one.
And the third space, like you, when was the third space, the original version of it, first published?
So it was about 8 years ago now.
Oh, really? That long ago?
Yeah. So it's been a concept that we've worked on for quite a lot of time. You know, it's still one of the most popular things that we've ever developed. And obviously with COVID, we re-released the book with updated work around, well, if I'm working from home or I'm in a hybrid model, how do I manage it in that context?
Yeah. And I guess that hybrid model too, like is it true to say that the hybrid model has become something that has been utilized more because of COVID?
Look, I think, I mean, obviously we had to transition home. And I think our ability to do that was extraordinary. You know, most organizations had their entire workforce working out of their home. And if you went into the average organization and said, all right, we're going to move everyone home, you go, all right, let's give us 18 months to plan that out.
Yeah, I know.
We did it in a week and we did it well. But now that people have had the taste of working from home, I just don't think we're going to go back, because what all the data shows is that we've maintained our productivity. Like we've still got stuff done, we've delivered, so we can work from home. And our research shows the majority of people said that they won't go back to full-time working out of the office, that it is going to be a hybrid model. But here's a very important part of our research, is that what we showed is that over 2020 and into this year, that people have felt that they've stayed in touch with their team well. You know, they've still communicated, they've had interactions virtually, and they've managed their workflow well. But what has increased over the year is a feeling of disconnection from their colleagues. So they feel disconnected and isolated, and that's increased. So what we need is, I think moving forward, we still need people to come back to the office, because they've got to connect and have a visceral experience and be in the same room as other people, but they don't have to do that full time. And I think hybrid is going to be the way forward.
Yeah. Is a hybrid, say, this is just a thought, because this is something that we do in our own business. We've got, I guess, our own version of a hybrid model, but have you experienced that, say different variations on that, where if somebody has is really primarily working from home and everyone else in the team is also working from home, but the hybrid model might then mean that they meet up, you know, a certain amount of times per week still?
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah, definitely. And it's just that, I mean, some organizations have been doing this for years. Microsoft in the US had a activity-based working, and other organizations have done it where work's something you do, not a place you go. So people were allowed to work from wherever they wanted. Their only stipulation was you have to come in once a week for your weekly team meeting. But yeah, I think very much we're going to see all sorts of variations of it, whether it's 80% in the office, 20% at home, or any variation of that.
Yeah, I see that you had, there's one of the statistics too that I was reading in relation to all this that you have, that you had 64% of people said that from working from home, they're thinking about work more in their personal time. And that's and there was a couple of other ones too, but if, could you just, I guess, elaborate on that a little bit more and then how, like as a result of those sort of statistics, are there particular strategies or things that you obviously elaborate more in the third space, but just a little bit more insight in how to address those sort of things?
Yeah. So what we started to look at is over this year, we've been doing research with people from various organizations about what is the impact of working from home on their ability to detach from the day. So 65% of people said that now I'm working from home, I find it much more difficult to separate work and home. So the two worlds have bled together. There's no delineation anymore. Because, I mean, and what people said is, I don't miss my commute. Like, no one misses sitting in traffic or being pressed up against some sweaty guy on a train. Like, no one misses that. What we miss is what the commute gave us. And the commute gave us that sort of signal of the day's done, you're going home now. And the other thing it gave us was some me time to decompress from the day, to sort of think about our world and be quiet before we go home. So what we're missing is that. And if you're working from home, what you've got to do is create your own virtual commute, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, a fake commute, or, you know, essentially what you've got to do is create your own third space. So previously, that the main research we did was that most people commuted home. So we looked at, well, what can you do in that commute to transition home so that you leave the workday behind, but you're much more present and focused and engaged in the home. What you've got to do now, if you're working from home, you've got to create that for yourself. So you've literally got to create a commute. Now, this is where it comes, and this is where people have to use their own initiative to go, well, how can I create that? But yeah, I spoke to a guy during COVID who'd read the new version of the book, and he said, oh man, he said that thing saved my life, because I was working from home and, you know, I was kind of never on, but I was never off, and the two worlds bled. And he said, I used to drive to work. So what I'd do is get up in the morning, get dressed for work. I get in the car, I go to the local coffee shop, I have a coffee, I drive back to the house, and that's a signal that it's work time. He said, at the end of the day, I get changed out of my work clothes. He said, one of the most important things was to get dressed for work. I get dressed out of my work clothes, I put on casual exercise gear, get in the car, drive to the local park. I walk around the park a couple of times listening to a podcast. He said, I drive home. Now it's dad, husband time. And he said that separation was vital. And some people are going, well, I do a walk at the start or the end of the day, or I go to the gym, or I do some relaxation or yoga, or even I was talking to a group in Asia Pac, and they said, well, yeah, this is great, but we're in Singapore and we're in high-rise buildings and we're not really allowed to leave. Like, we can't go out. Well, at that point, they weren't. And so one of the women in the group, what she did is her family, after the kids finished their work and she finished her work, they got together and they all cooked dinner as an experience. Like, each kid picked a recipe and they played music And that was their sort of transition. Other people are talking about hobbies, gardening, but it's just what can you create to separate those two worlds? And even just packing up your stuff and putting your work away so it's not in your line of sight also makes a really big difference.
Yeah. I have to wonder too, just with you saying about, you know, people with, say, hobbies or new things that they that are then used, I guess, to establish a routine again, because I suppose one of the things too, I think anyway, when I think of what makes, like you were saying before, what makes a daily it easier to separate than work from home and then be able to relax better is having a specific routine. You've got those different spaces within it. So I have to wonder too, because we, like I guess like a lot of people, have been doing the same. We've been returning to do some new or some more of existing hobbies and things that we always like. But I have to wonder, and I'll be really interested to hear your thoughts on this, as to whether that is not only just as a result of being at home more, but because of maybe like an innate need then to have more routine.
Yeah.
And so therefore you go, I want, you know, it's obviously enjoyable, but, and you're at home more, so but is that also maybe a part of that, just a way to sort of establish a routine, like a subconscious, in a way to create it for yourself again?
Yeah, routines are critical for us. One of the things, if you look at retirement, for athletes and retirement for workers is devastating. They really struggle with it. And one of the things, if you look at the retirement research, they talk about is a lack of routine. So athletes said, I loved that my day had structure. And now that I've retired, that structure's gone. Mm. Same with people who retire from work. So what we found is when people were working from home, there was a lack of routine. And putting structure in place is very, very important for people. Now, if we want to go deep on this concept, myself and Deakin University, we studied, well, what makes the best transition possible? And this initial research was done in the commute from work to home. So there's three phases that you want to do in a good transition. The first phase is called reflect. And that is where you reflect on what you've just gone through. Humans are sense-making machines. We love to make sense of what we've just done. So what you want to do is, as you finish work, so if we're talking about the transition from work to home, is had like sort of pack the day away and make sense of it. Now, the problem is what we find is most people, when they reflect on their work day, reflect on, oh, all the crap stuff. Like, I didn't do that, or I forgot that, or, oh God, that was a disaster. So what we got people to do instead was to reflect on, well, what went well today? What did I achieve? What did I get done? How did I improve? And that what that does is gives them a burst of happiness and makes them more optimistic. That's the first phase. The second phase is called rest. And all it means is do something that makes you mindful and present. Could be exercise, could be listening to a podcast, it could be reading a book, relaxation. But it's anything that just starts to calm the brain down, because our workday is so chaotic. Our brain starts to really speed up and it gets used to that pace. So it's about calming the brain. And then the third thing, well, the last phase is called reset. And this is where we think about what we're wanting to achieve in the next space. Like, how do we want to show up? What sort of impact do we have? What's our intention? And so we got people to practice these three steps between work and home for a month. And we saw a 43% improvement in mood in the home. Right. So the homes got happier by 43%. We saw a 91% increase in boundary strength, which is the ability to have a bad day and not take it home with you. So if we want to get quite detailed about this, those three phases help people transition most effectively.
Mm. What about the, because there seems to be just in the general topic and, you know, and different outcomes of things you've been talking about, there seems to be some sort of correlation then between like skills learned through these processes and what you're talking with, behavioral agility, and then things like visualization too. I'm just making an assumption there because I'm sort of thinking about, you know, I'm just trying, I suppose, to make sense of like why that seems, you know, to have a correlation. But do you have thoughts around that? Like when, say, sports people helping themselves to visualize, you know, an outcome, is there like a relationship between their ability or skill set to be able to separate things off well, like into parts?
Well, look, the visualization piece really comes into that final phase of that reset piece. Now, in our research, it wasn't so much a visualization, which the 80s and the 90s was big for athletes practicing visualization, and some research showed that it made an impact. The reflect phase of the third space reset phase is much more about just future pacing. All right, I'm about to go into this space, whether it's my home, whether it's a meeting, whether it's a hard conversation. And it's just getting people to think about, what am I trying to achieve? How do I want to show up? Like, what sort of behaviors do I want to exhibit? What is the outcome I'm after? It's much more about preparing yourself for that interaction. Because Duke University showed that around 50% of our day we're not conscious of how we show up. We're just kind of in automatic mode. And so often people, you know, arrive at interactions or meetings and don't have clarity about what they're trying to achieve or what impact they're trying to have. So it's just being much more mindful. And I suppose visualization is part of it. I suppose you are doing visualization of, you know, in this meeting, here's what I want to achieve. Here's how I want to behave. Or if you're doing a presentation, here's the outcome I want. So I think there's definitely parallels between those two worlds.
Yeah, it was just something that I guess came about as I was listening to you speak too, because you've obviously been involved with sports people as well, and speaking about, I think I was reading on the website too about people who are high, high achievers, or who are good at that ability to change, that idea of being agile. I mean, not only physically, but then mentally too.
Yeah, and it makes me think of, I once spoke at a conference with McGrath, the cricketer. I've forgotten his first name. The bowler. Ian Healy was the other one. So, I can't remember. Glenn McGrath, that's it.
Glenn, yeah.
So I spoke to them at different conferences and they saw me present the third space, and each of them came up to me afterwards and went, oh, do you know who's the best at that? Warnie. They said, Warnie is amazing. That guy's ability to like transition. And they said he could be on the front page of the Telegraph in his underwear in some scandal. And they said when he walked through those gates onto that field, it's like it never happened. His ability to just drop himself into the present moment and perform was amazing. Yeah. But also they said his ability to handle pressure. Like too often, you know, as we move into the next space, if we're under pressure, we tend to fall apart. I think it was Ian Healy said this to us. He said, we could be in the worst position and the players would literally say to each other, yeah, but we've got Warnie. Like, they always had hope if he was on the field. His ability to deliver when under pressure was amazing.
Isn't
that
interesting?
Maybe not so great in his personal life.
Yeah, different sorts of flexibility, I suppose. Hey.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's an interesting point too, because I just made this sort of funny correlation in my mind. I like playing squash, and I look at a lot of squash online. And look at a lot of the pro players playing, and then you see occasionally I've looked at different documentaries when they're talking, like socially, when they're not on the court and they're playing. Mm. And there was one guy in particular who I think is number one or number two in the world now. And when I've seen him talk, it's sort of hard to quantify why I felt this, but off the court, he's just talking, he's very relaxed and seemingly a completely different person to when I see him playing. He even looks like a completely different person. And my assumption has always been, it just sort of made a bit more of a link there between it, is that I know mentally as a player, just judging by watching games, he's got a sort of uncanny ability, like those really high performers do, to even when they're very down, to somehow actually end up winning. Like even when they're, you know, in many other people would be completely down, he seems to be able to flick the switch, and you can almost see it visually happen, like in his face. And that's very different to then seeing him talking. It's obviously my assumption there is that, you know, when he goes onto the court, he's able to, you know, be in a different space very effectively and very quickly.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I went and saw a lecture by a guy called Jim Lewis, who wrote a book called The Powerful Engagement. And what he talked about is, if you look at the top 100 male tennis players, he said they're identical. They all hit the ball as hard. They run as fast as each other. They're as accurate, as agile as each other. He said, but what separates the elite players is not what they do during the point, but what they do in between the points. And what he showed is the elite players could lose a point and get over it really fast. Like they don't take it into the next point. They drop the baggage and move on, whereas the lower ranked players carry that with them. He said they can also, they use that gap in between points to relax, like their heart rate drops more, their blood pressure. They actually use that space to conserve energy, which obviously in a five-set match, that makes a difference. Mm. And the last thing is, as they move into that next space, all they think about is that moment in time. They're completely present. So Jim's thing was, it's not what they do during the point, but it's what they do in between the points that really separates them.
Yeah, once again, the spaces within the spaces, hey?
Yeah, so, very much.
Yeah, I mean, there was a couple of different training things that I have watched relating to squash that actually analyzes what some of those things are in the squash context about some people's cues, like physical cues that they give themselves to help them do that, involve, you know, just a few deep breaths. They involve bouncing the ball always the same amount of times in between serving, and it's. And then when you watch it, it's like, wow, that's actually really amazing. Like you don't notice it unless you're looking for it, but they have visual cues that give them, that almost switch a psychological trigger for them that go, this means I've got to relax. And then it works because they've trained themselves to do that. And then they're able to.
Yeah, and most athletes have that routine. I remember having a conversation with Kerry Potthast, who won a gold medal in beach volleyball. She talked about that you choke in between the points. Like that's where you do your head in when you've got time to think. And she talked about the routine that she did. Even, Nadal, the tennis player who's got OCD, you know, talks about like he bounces that ball that many times because he's slowing his heart rate down and he's waiting for his body to get to a point of relaxation before he serves.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's routine in that third space is so important for athletes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And you can see that, you know, I could see other things that we've already been discussing about, you know, different things for people to be able to effectively transition from one space to another one. Like the importance of that, like, seems to be, it's sort of been highlighted to me. I'm speaking to you that, you know, just how important that is.
And even if you think about people working at home doing back-to-back Zoom meetings, like just taking that couple of moments before they go into the next virtual meeting to just kind of reset themselves, to focus on what they want to achieve, to take a moment to relax and calm their brain. Like it's only small moments, but they make colossal impacts.
Yeah, definitely. I was interested also I had a brief look at the Flourish movement. Also, I mean, it was obviously related a bit to what we're talking about, but I would I'd just be interested if you'd like to explain a little bit about what that is.
Yeah, the Flourish movement was we were approached by a group of school principals on the South Coast about 5 years ago now. And what they were talking about was how the job of a school principal had become more complex and it was really having an impact on their well-being. And so we started to research the job and study it. We pulled it apart, got them to do diary studies and interviews and surveys. And from that, we co-designed with the principals an intervention to address their well-being, their effectiveness, their resilience, their ability to cope with, like, it is a tough job. So we've been running it for the last 5 years nationally. Over 1,000 principals have been through this program. It's got extraordinary results in terms of improving well-being and effectiveness and enjoyment of the role. It's vital. It's probably, I think it's one of the most fulfilling things I've ever done.
Wow, really? I've been involved a little bit in education outside of our own industry, like in the creative industries, and just outside of the educational aspect of it, just being any sort of leader, you know, can be like a really tough job. And when I saw that, I thought, wow, like I'd never sort of encountered something specific about that particular area. And I was really interested to know more, because it, you know, obviously highlights that every industry and every sector where you've got a leader of some sort, the importance of, you know, of them, of what they do and their leadership and everything that flows down from that to everybody else is just so important.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, education has evolved dramatically, and rather than we're the recipients of education now, education's a service. Like we literally see ourselves as customers. And when our kids go to school, it's like, okay, I'm sending my kids here. What do I get? You know, what do I get for my money if it's a private school? Or, you know, so for educators, it's become so much more demanding. And also our mentality has changed from, you know, in my day, if you got bad marks, you got told, get your crap together and study harder. Whereas if you get a bad mark today, it's like, well, what did your teacher do that got you that bad result? The onus isn't on the student. It's on, well, how the school's failed them, rather than that kid hasn't applied themselves. So there's so much more social pressure. I mean, our access to them is greatly increased. So many principals, well, the majority have been threatened with violence or have received actual violence. And also it's the broadest job we've ever studied, meaning there's just so many aspects to it. It's a hugely challenging role, and I just don't think they get enough kudos.
No, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it could be its own topic for a podcast. I'm sure the philosophical shift of like education as a whole, everyone's got very strong views, I suppose, on that, on like whether it's a customer based, you know, whether that's good. I certainly have particular views on it, but, you know, or whether education is about, you know, job outcomes, or whether it's about being a better person or a mixture of them, who knows, you know. But, you know, it is what it is now. But, yeah, it's certainly something that when I saw that, I think everybody reading that would inherently probably know, like, it's a damn hard job, but they don't. You know, I mean, I wouldn't. My mum was, I was high school teacher, and she was very well liked, but she was at a pretty rough school, and she had, like, just as a teacher, she had a lot of very challenging sort of situations in her school. And, you know, just even, you know, having those little glimpses into that world, I've got, you know, it's like a huge amount of respect for people who generally always teachers or headmasters, because they are passionate about helping people. You know, they're passionate about, like, educating kids. You know, they're just us.
Yeah, they're incredibly dedicated. And they do a really good job. And if you look at what they achieved in COVID, it was extraordinary. Like, they had a couple of weeks to make everything virtual. It was just, it was a huge challenge, but they stepped up to it and they did it really well.
Yeah. I think generally, just looking at when I reflect on what people generally have done in organizations and businesses and schools, I think everyone adapted super quick and really well.
Oh, you know, totally.
That's totally my take on it. People in Australia, I mean, I can't speak for overseas, but, you know, they certainly did here in Australia.
It shows how adaptable and resilient we are.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, that's like as we get, I guess, towards, you know, the end of the podcast, and we've covered, like, it's an amazing sort of subject, and like I'll certainly be, I'm going to get my hands on the book too. Like I haven't, you know, I didn't actually know about it until we started talking and you were introduced to me too, but I'd be really interested to read it. And I guess on that point, like as we're wrapping it up, what's the best way for people listening to the podcast to find out about you, to find out about the book? Where do they go, and what do they do, Adam?
Yeah, well, I mean, my website, which is dradamfraser.com, which is dradamfraser.com, that's the best place to sort of find me and resources. You know, YouTube, we've got a number of YouTube videos on the third space. I think one of them's up to over 150,000 views or something.
That's pretty good.
It's an animated video that explains the concept.
I saw that one actually. That's good.
So obviously the book goes into it in much more detail and more practical examples, but that's kind of the best way to get me.
Have you got an audiobook version of it?
Yes, we do. So we've recorded the audio book of The Third Space, so that's available as well.
That's right. Is that you speaking?
Yeah, it sure is. That was me in a little booth for 4 days.
Fantastic. Yeah, no. So I'll just ask you to, if you don't have one, it's okay. But have you got like some amazing inspirational quote that you'd like to provide, or someone that or a quote that you really like that you feel is, say, relevant to what we've been speaking about that you'd like to share? Or you can make one on the spot, Adam, if you like.
The ones that come to mind, I mean, we're doing a lot of new research around courage, like how do you be courageous? And that research in psychology has evolved quite dramatically. One of my favorite quotes is, "Don't believe everything you think." And what it talks about is the fact that most of our stories and thoughts are incredibly inaccurate and not helpful. So, like, you almost have to treat your own thoughts and stories with a grain of salt. One of my favorite, it was said to me by a mate of mine called Colin James. He said, "What you have to realize is that no one anywhere in the world knows what the hell is going on." He said, "We're all just making it up."
Oh, man, so true. So true.
It's very true.
Somehow I always find that comforting. I really don't know why, but I always find that comforting, because it makes me feel like everyone's just completely on the same page.
Yeah, and one of the things we're doing with this new research around courage and how do we be courageous, when we run workshops, we get people to articulate like, what are the real negative things they say about themselves to themselves, about their ability or their capacity to do their job? And sometimes I have like insanely senior business people in a room, and we get in a circle like we're at AA, and each person gives one, and it's always like imposter syndrome. I'm a fraud. Someone will work it out one day. Not good enough. Haven't achieved enough. And when we go around the circle, it's the exact same thing comes out for everyone. It's wow. about like we're not good enough. We haven't done well, or someone's going to work out that we don't really know what we're doing. And it's transformative for people, because most people stand in that circle and go, oh my gosh, I thought I was the only one in this place that felt like that.
That is so true. That's so true. Yeah. That's so true.
And some of those people that I'm doing this activity with, their annual income is like the GDP of a small nation. Like, these are senior, very experienced people, and that feeling rarely goes away.
I think that's a fantastic way to finish things up. Actually, that's a great point. And I'd just like to take the time to thank you so much for sharing all of that. It's been a fantastic podcast. And have you got anything else you'd like to share, Adam?
No, just I encourage people to practice and use the third space, whether they're moving from work to home or from home to work or one interaction to another, just because what we know is that it really works. Like, it's an incredibly effective strategy, and it's one that you can practice and get better at. So I encourage people to go out there and try it and keep practicing it and improving it.
Fantastic. So with that in mind, that's actually it for today, guys. Thanks so much for listening into our podcast yet again. Before we go, please leave your feedback as well as any suggestions for any topics you'd like us to discuss in future episodes. And thanks again for listening to the Grey Business Podcast, and we'll see you again soon. Bye, guys.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Grow Your Business. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time here at the Grow Your Business Podcast.